We'll talk about this picture here in a moment, but to introduce this story, I have a different story. And it involves my grandmother, and a couple things you need to know about this is, one, I love my grandmother dearly. She is amazing, and I don't know why exactly our connection is what it is, but we get along great and can go hours, days, and so on where, you know, it's just a blast. But second thing you need to know is she is crazy. She, not literally, but she's kind of out there. A real brief example of that, and so maybe that has some shedding of light on why I get along with her so well. But anyway, family dinners, I remember multiple times, Thanksgiving, Christmas, she'd have the meal all prepared. One particular time, it was spaghetti, and she's talking a mile a minute, and she's all distracted and real absent-minded, so she's going around and serving spaghetti sauce on everyone's salad, and it's just talking away, and no one said anything because they're just like, well, we want to wait and see what she does next, so we don't want to clear. So that's the kind of crazy I'm talking about. And the story I wanted to share with you about her is this would have been at least two decades ago. Her and my aunt, so her daughter, were traveling down from southern Ohio to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And my aunt is a school teacher as well, so she had just gotten off of the school day on the weekends, and she was pretty much done. And she had already been driving a few hours, and she probably knew this wasn't a great idea, but she's like, well, I guess I can let Mom drive for a little while. And, of course, that happens, and then she passes out, and she's taking a nap for 2 or 3 hours. She wakes up, and she's like, how are we doing, Grandma? And she's like, we're doing great. We're making a great time. There hasn't been hardly any traffic. This has been amazing. And my aunt turns and she starts seeing signs for so many miles to Cincinnati and so on. So she'd been driving the wrong direction for a couple hours, but she was making a great time. So that's my grandmother. But she's a blast to be around, is the bottom line. But I'll have to say how that gets us to this picture. The first place I heard it was Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He has this quote. I don't know if it came from before him, but that's where I picked it up. And it's a quote that goes, if you board the wrong train, it is of no use to run along the corridor in opposite direction. So that's kind of, you know, why I shared the grandma story. But the reason I bring that up is twofold, but we can see this summarized. I won't be talking about atheism and creationism today, but we can see that as an example very readily. There's some incredibly intelligent atheists out there that have more processing power than I'll ever be able to muster, and they're not, you know, biologically stupid or anything, but they've boarded the wrong train, and it really doesn't matter how much you spin your wheels and what you try and do beyond that. You're on the wrong train, buddy, and you're going to have to get off it if you're going to get to any true knowledge and actual truth. And so, as a parallel to this thought, we're going to be working our way into a passage in James 2 that I'll be suggesting that the popular view of that passage has, and for many different reasons, boarded the wrong train. And so there's been a whole bunch of spinning of wheels and a whole bunch of, you know, hermeneutical hoops that have been jumped through to try and explain it. And my suggestion will be that, well, maybe we should go back and see whether we even boarded the right train and see if we need to reevaluate some things. So that's big picture where we're going. You may have seen this is actually just going to be our first time talking about this in 3 weeks, I believe it is. We will finish it up. So we will just barely be dipping our toes into James chapter 2 at the end of today. By end of today, I mean about 5 o'clock, so don't worry. No, not that long. But I'll have, if you flip on the backside, as long as you don't go too far and just stay with us, it's okay to cheat. I have a total of 8 misconceptions that I'll be sharing, but today we're only going to look at 5 of them. And so from my perspective, I would see these as if you got one of these wrong and you really bought into one of these misconceptions, you would basically be boarding a train that is not going to take you in a direction where you're going to be able to make any sense out of James 2, from my opinion. So we're going to go through these and see if any of them make sense and go from there. Our first misconception is that the book of James is a random collection of wise sayings akin to Proverbs. So no one's going to argue that James is obviously incredibly practical and has great wisdom and has significant parallel to Old Testament wisdom literature. The point that we're contesting is it just a random collection? You know, is this just, you know, just a piecemeal? You go to one verse and it's a completely different topic than the next verse, and so it's all hit or miss. So we're going to say that that's false, that there is nothing random or disconnected about the book of James, and that the outline for the book of James is found in chapter 1, verse 19, which you can find there if you have your Bibles with you. And in that verse, it's a verse that often gets memorized in Awana. He gives us the three headings of the book of how it's structured. And so this is not uncommon by any stretch of the imagination. Classical Greek authors, this was just the norm that they would put this towards the end of their prologue introduction. They'd give a theme statement about the structure of how of their letter or their book that they were writing. The New Testament authors took advantage of this and structured their books as well like this. And here I'd say that in the book of James we find the same thing. So you have the three sections of swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to wrath. Now, the real easy one is that middle one, chapter 3. You're not going to get a lot of argument there that that's about the slow to speak part. People don't have a problem with that. Usually the one people have a little contention with is the slow to wrath, because they're like, well, it's talking about money in different parts in there. What would money have to do with getting angry? I'm just like, well, that just so happens to be one of the number one reasons why people get into arguments and so forth is financial stuff. But anyway, continuing forward, looking at what's big picture, what is James talking about in his book as a whole? Because we're suggesting that there is a structure and that he does have an overall message. So in verse 1, 2 through 4, he's saying that believers may be complete in trials, that they, and that term there for complete is being brought to its proper goal. So we're going to make more of a point of that 3 weeks from today, because we're going to see that same reference get pulled up in chapter 2 of how the faith is brought to its proper goal. And so suggesting, hey, maybe he hasn't changed his train of thought here, and maybe there is a structure that's going on here. Next, that believers need to readily receive the implanted word that is able to save your souls. Now, that's going to be a fun one. That's going to be a different, I think it's number 4, misconception number 4 we're going to look at today, of what in the world does that mean, that whole phrase. So you're going to have to hold on to that one for a minute, but big picture, that's what James is wanting you to do. He's saying if you want to be successful in trials and be complete, have yourself brought to its proper goal as a believer, then you are going to need to receive this word that is able to save your soul. So we'll have to leave it at that for now. So the application of this, why would I talk about this being an important thing to mention in terms of boarding the wrong train that could really mess you up down the road? Well, bottom line is the salvation that gets talked about in this section of chapter 2 must not be separated from the context that we're in of chapter 1 and 2. So the structure has already set it up that this is the unit, and so you can't just willy-nilly say, well, I want it to be talking about this right now. I know that's popular in postmodern thought of just you make everything mean what you want it to mean, and you do what you want, when you want, how you want. But the point is, James does confine us, and if he has this structured to where he's talking about this and he introduces the topic and we're still in that section, it's not up to us to say, well, to me it means, and so, you know, I'll start throwing up if I hear people say that too often. But anyway, that's the bottom line application to that. The second misconception is that the book of James is written to both believers and unbelievers, saying it's a mixed group. And so this also relates to the not having a structure as well. They're just like, well, maybe you're in this verse, and that's about, for you know, that's instruction for believers, but you hop two verses over, and now we're talking about unbelievers, and you just go back and forth, back and forth, because they don't think there's a structure. So these kind of piggyback on each other. I will disagree with that, and we'll look at some reasons why here just a second, but it's written to my beloved brethren, and we'll look at the usage of how he uses brethren up to the point that we're going to be in chapter 2, and you can ask yourself, is this reasonable that he's referring to unbelievers when he says that? So the first place, chapter 1, verses 2 and 3, count it all joy, my brethren, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. So, first thing we know, it would be a little bit odd to think that James is telling unbelieving Jews to consider trials as joy. That'd be a little bit odd. Why would they consider it a joy as an unbeliever? Secondly, why would he be speaking of their faith? If they're not believers, then why are you speaking about their faith? That would be a little bit, some questions to answer. The next usage, found in verse 18. Of his own will, he brought us forth by the word of truth that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. So here we have an undisputed reference to the new birth, regeneration. They've been born again. James is defining his use of brethren here as regenerate believers. And so the next usage of brethren is in the very next verse, verse 19, which gives the same, my beloved brethren, some very practical application for the Christian life, which we looked at as the theme verse for the whole book. The next one, chapter 2, verse 1, my brethren, show no partiality as you hold the faith in our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory. So in the first place, this is a continuation of a string of uses of the brethren that refer to regenerate people. Secondly, James specifies here that these brethren have what? They have faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. So if you're going to argue the other direction that he's talking to unbelievers, you're arguing against what James is saying is the bottom line. He isn't leaving this as some vague term. He's saying, I'm talking to you guys, you believers here. Final one here. Chapter 3, so this is actually just after our section we'll be looking at later on. 3, verse 1. Not many of you should become teachers, my brethren, for you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness. So, we joke because I do teach at a Christian school, and so this is one of those passages that gives me the willies. And if it doesn't give you the willies, then don't worry, I have enough I can share. But bottom line is James warning that not many of these unbelievers should become teachers? Is that even a part of the suggestion? That's what you'd have to conclude if you're saying this is a mixed group. Is that even an option? So what I'd suggest is this is a very common interpretational tool or a principle, rather, is that if the details of the text don't fit what you think it's saying and it's absurd, just throw it in the trash can. So that's what I would suggest. Throw this concept that James doesn't have a defined readership. Just throw it in the trash can because it kind of just gets you into trouble later on. Misconception number 3. And because I just forgot the application of all that, when we get to chapter 2 of James, what has commonly been done in that passage is to say, well, this is great. I hope these unbelievers are listening to this because this doesn't apply to me at all. It's one of those, it's probably been 7 years since Dr. Meisinger was here, but if he pulled out his umbrella for you guys, I don't know if he did that. And it's called the spiritual umbrella, where you have this application coming down, and it's like, well, I hope so-and-so over there is listening to this, because he really needs this. It's like, well, maybe you need this. You know, so it's one of those defense mechanisms that we like to put up and say, well, that doesn't apply to me. So what I'm saying is when we do get there in chapter 2, this is something that is for believers, and it's something that we need to take in. Misconception number 3, we've gone over this before, so I do have some slides on this, but we'll go pretty briskly through this. Don't want to beat the dead horse too much, but the idea is that save or salvation always refers to eternal salvation or lake of fire, and you guys should already know that just simply isn't true, and it's unlikely that you're going to hear someone come out and say that. I don't think I've heard anyone say, oh yeah, it's always referring to that. It's what they do. They'll get in a passage, and I kid you not, you see it in their eyes. They read that word save, and you can see the knee-jerk reaction. Like, oh my goodness, lake of fire. We're talking about lake of fire. And I realize what happens is because in English, that is the most common way we use that term. You know, we say, well, are you saved? And we're used as a technical term for are you going to heaven when you die? And I'm not arguing against that or saying that's wrong to use it that way. What I am saying is we have to come to the realization that Scripture routinely does not use in that sense. It's actually 85-90% of the time it uses it in some completely different sense. And so if we go into it thinking it always refers to eternal salvation, you're going to severely be boarding the wrong train. So just a quick review of some different ways in which it's used. You have Matthew 8, when the disciples are out on the sea and the severe storm comes. And they say, Lord, save us, we're about to die. So there, that doesn't have anything about lake of fire or anything. They just physically need to be saved. Next chapter of Matthew, you have the woman with the medical hemorrhaging problem, and she comes to Jesus that she may be saved, and she touched him, and she was saved from that very hour. So there, it's, once again, nothing to do about lake of fire. Chapter 27 of Matthew, you have Jesus up on the cross, and the outsiders are looking. They don't realize that he's the one that put himself up there and that he's submitting himself to this. This is part of his plan. And so they're like, wow, look at this predicament he's got himself into. He needs someone to save him from this. And so they're wanting to see if Elijah will come save him. So there Jesus is talked about needing salvation. James 5:15, we have, and the prayer of faith will save the one who is sick, and the Lord will raise him up. So there, it'd be a little bit silly if someone was saying, oh, wow, it's talking about eternal salvation. Well, just read a few words more. You can see this person is physically sick and needs deliverance. And one final one I always include just for fun, 1 Timothy 2:15, yet she will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith and love and holiness with self-control. So you'd have to ask yourself, if you want to go the road of saying, well, every time I see this word, I'm going to de facto think about eternal salvation. Sorry, guys, you're out of luck. Unless you find out a way to medically to have a kid, then there's no salvation for you here. Sorry. So bottom line of all that, stop. When you see the word save or deliver, slow down and start asking some questions about what are we talking about. And just as I'll definitely go quick through this because this will be review for you. Just on the spiritual end of it, of the way salvation gets used in the Bible, you have, if you want to break it down in the time elements of past, present, future, you have different parts of that. You have justification, being declared righteous by faith. You have deliverance from the penalty of sin. You have deliverance from the lake of fire. Those are all past events that get dealt with once you believe. And then present, you have sanctification, being set apart. You have deliverance from the power of sin, sin's tyrannical rule in your life. You have discipleship, so that's the ongoing present process of following Christ. And then finally, you have a meaningful life. So living to give God glory is that which gives our life significance. Sanctification delivers us from an insignificant and meaningless life. Now, the final one for future, you have glorification, which is deliverance from the very presence of sin. You have to look forward to the resurrection body, where all the ailments that we have today will no longer be present. And then, as well as conformity to Christ, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. So this is by no stretch of the imagination everything you could lump in here. This is just a really concise summary to expand the brain a little bit and say, hey, I need to be aware that every time this word is used, there's a whole wide range of possibilities, and I need to be tethered to what's going on in the context, what's been said before, what is he talking about now, what's after it, so on. So this is what I like to do and suggest for people is some questions you can ask to get a head start on what's going on. So when you see this term, you can say, who is being delivered? You can ask, when are they delivered? Is this a process? Is this a one-time event? Is it a procedure? So on and so on. From what are they delivered? How do they obtain this deliverance? So the means, do they have to do something? Is this something only God does? Is it cooperation? So on and so on. And then to what are they delivered? So where's what they're being brought to? So they're getting out of this, but what are they being brought to? So those are just some suggestions that you can apply when you see these terms come up. So the next one we've also talked about, but it's been a few years, I don't remember how many, about this phrase, to save a soul. And so the misconception would be that that means to gain eternal salvation and go to heaven when you die. And let me just say that's very understandable, given the English translation of soul, because it's literally just suke, like psychology. So we wouldn't think psychology is about gaining eternal salvation. So just knowing that can help a little bit. But there is that range of meaning in English where we use the word soul to mean like your eternal spirit. And so if you go down that road, then that's definitely not going to be helpful in understanding what's being related here. So we're going to say that this is false, that to save a life, so the better translation would just be life because that's all the word really means, is a common Greek idiom for preserving one's physical life. And like I said, because we've looked at these before, we'll go through this quick, but just to explain again, what's an idiom, just in case that's not a familiar word. Every language has their own phrases and colloquial sayings that are their own, so it just means one's own. And in English, we could say, what's he up to? And for us, that's not a big deal. We just say, okay, he's up to no good, and we're questioning his motives or something. But if you're a foreign speaker learning language and you're trying to piecemeal this together, what does a sentence mean? You're like, what is he up to? You're going to get pretty lost because you don't know that it's a package deal and you're just adding up this part plus this part plus this part, and you get done and you're like, this doesn't make any sense. Same thing with the next one, up the creek. You know, we know that, at least Southerners do, as he's in a whole bunch of trouble. He's in a mess. But a foreigner coming in that it's not their own language would be like, up the creek, is like, we're in New Mexico. There's hardly any water here. This doesn't make any sense either. So the bottom line of what we'd be relating here is these idioms in any language, you don't take them as a little addition problem and go this word plus this word plus this word, and then you have the meaning. It's one unit package deal. You have to take the whole phrase, and that has a meaning. So that's the same case with this idiom. We have to save a life is used 11 times. In each of those cases, we're not going to look at all of them, we'll just look about four or five of them. It's used of delivering their physical life. So our first one, you have the example of Sodom and Gomorrah. And there, I can't think of anyone that would want to argue that this is talking about their eternal salvation. He's literally saying, if you don't get yourselves out of here, you're going to be, you know, burned up or a pillar of salt pretty quick here. Next one, Genesis 32:30, Jacob wrestling with God, and he gets at the end. He's like, wow, I've seen God face to face, and yet my life has been spared. So Saitain Sukain, the Greek idiom, used there again. So once again, use a physical deliverance. And then 1 Samuel 19:11, you have the context of David fleeing from Saul. And so there's no difficulty there saying that this idiom is being used, that he wants to escape with his life. And that the words in red there are representing the Greek phrase of the idiom we're talking about. And then the New Testament gets used the same way. The first place it's used chronologically would be here in Matthew 3:4. And he said to them, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill? So exact same idiom package phrase there, and we can see from the context very clearly he's not talking about eternal salvation and going to heaven when you die. So that is the bottom line here. The pull-up, I have to keep in mind I'm borderline legally blind. I keep passing the state test for my driver's license, so I haven't been forced to get glasses yet, but sometimes I have to look down here at my own notes. So here we have it expanded, this idiom, to delivering our lives from meaninglessness, wastefulness, and the ravaging consequences of sin. A fulfillment of the purpose of your physical life, in other words. So when your life is saved, you are actively experiencing the victorious Christian life, the abundant life. You are truly living, in other words. So this is also the parallel that you get in the Old Testament when it says, are you going to choose life or choose death? It's talking about their experience. Are you going to go this way or this way? So ultimately, yes, if they go that way, they're going to not only physically die, but if that's the only thing they've chosen and they've never trusted in God, then that ultimately leads there. But it more specifically is talking about their life experience. What kind of life choices are you making? So here we see this idiom is expanded in the New Testament to, yes, it starts with your physical life, but like Jesus commonly does, he starts with the physical, the tangible, and expands it to the spiritual. And he says, okay, what's the meaning and purpose behind that spiritual life? And so that's when we looked at this before, was the whole, losing yourself, and he who dies for my sake will find himself. So if you live for Christ, then you've actually found the true meaning of your life, even if you lost your physical life, you still found what that purpose of that life really was for. Next, We're going to cheat on this one. Hopefully, you haven't already looked at this one. If we get a volunteer here in a moment that is brave, we're going to have a question for you, actually several. So we're starting to get into James chapter 2. This is the final point we'll be looking at for today. But this is this section, chapter 2, we'll be looking at, starts in verse 14. And James says, hey guys, here's a very practical situation here. He's already talked about pure religion being feeding the widows and orphans. He's already talked about that, so he brings it up again because he's still in the same section. He says, what good is it going to do if you believers here see someone that's in need of food or shelter? You say, oh, go in peace. I'll be well with you, you know, best wishes. And they're just left there like, thank you. I still need some food and I need somewhere to sleep tonight. And he says, well, what use is that? What does that profit? Is that of any benefit at all? And the simple answer is it's not of any benefit at all. And so he goes on to say the statement of faith without works, faith apart from works, is dead. And so that's the first introduction of it. So you have to say, okay, what does he mean by that? And he goes on for another 10 verses, and we'll talk about what he means. He'll give, he'll first introduce an objector, someone that disagrees with him, and he'll let him speak. And then he rebuttals and says, oh, you foolish man that you are, let me tell you what the connection is. Then we get some illustrations from Abraham and Rahab. And then it concludes with this. But the point is, let's say you're just having a bad day, you have brain fog or something, and you just missed everything that he just said. You just spaced out for 10 verses, and you're like, okay, what just happened? Thankfully, he gives us this summary verse, this analogy, this conclusion at the end, to explain to us, what exactly do you mean when you say faith without works is dead? So this is what we find here at the end of the section, end of the chapter 2. For as the body, apart from the spirit, is dead, so also faith, apart from works, is dead. So let that sink in. Think about the parallel, the analogy of what is wrong. So now we need someone that's brave to answer, what does faith correspond to in this analogy that James is using? You only have two options. It either goes with body or it goes with spirit. 50-50. It goes with the body. 100% correct. A plus. Now, does that take a whole lot of brain power to figure that out? I don't know. I've done this a few times. I've never had a user of kids, and I've never had a kid get that wrong because it's pretty apparent, and it's like that's what he's using as an analogy. Go to the next one, and this one's even easier because we've eliminated half the options. What do the works correspond to? I would say for the works, it'd be the spirit. So just as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead. So the faith and the body get paired up together, analogy, and the works and the spirit get paired up. So what gives life to, or what energizes what? So if we put it in the fueling terms, what's fueling what here, according to what James is saying? So in the physical realm, the spirit fuels the body. And if it's the spirit's gone, then you just got this corpse. It's nothing useful can be done with it. What's fueling what here in the next part of the analogy? I sort of heard something. But Howard Hendricks always said, when you ask questions, you just wait till somebody answers, no matter how awkward. So we might be here a while. No one's. What's that? Okay, well, that's the popular view, so you won't be alone in that, but an analogy, if the spirit fuels the body in terms of energizing it, and that's what gives the body life, and James has paired works with the spirit, then the works give life to faith. So, it's a simple enough a parallel. Probably the biggest hindrance to seeing what is here in this verse is the reality that we've heard the popular review for however many years you've been alive, and it's really difficult to pull that out because, quite frankly, as we're about to see, this is a misconception we're talking about. So here's the bottom line of what he's saying, if you wanted to rephrase it. For as the body apart from the spirit is dead, so also faith apart from works is dead. So what he's saying is just as the spirit enlivens the body, works enliven our faith. So what's the problem with this? The problem is the most popular view of this passage is stating 100% the exact opposite. They're saying that faith produces or gives life to works necessarily. They're saying, well, this is talking about what unbelievers need to be worried about, and they need to check themselves out and see if they're legit, and because they think this passage is teaching that faith necessarily has to produce an undefined amount of works, or we shouldn't consider them a believer or whatnot. So the reason we say this false is because it's just not what James is talking about. It's just not on the table of discussion at this point. And we see from this analogy, it's very simple, it's very straightforward, that works give life to or energize our faith. And unfortunately, you're just going to have to hold on to that for the moment, because we can't go into detail until we get to the next part in 3 weeks, but it'll be some food for thought and just say, okay, if the analogy is real simple and it's straightforward and it doesn't go with the popular view, what do I do now? Well, once again, I'd find the nearest trash can, but anyway, we have here I'm going to go back actually one, because that's distracting. That dog's really distracting now that I look at it on a big screen. So the summarize the principle here, works enliven our faith. When works are absent in our lives, our faith has lost that which animates it, and thus is aptly described as dead. Can something that is dead be used to save a life, to bring life? Of course not. It is this life and death contrast in James that makes such a suggestion absurd. This harkens us back to the reality that James is still talking about what it means to be swift to hear. James has already stated that the brethren should so say and so do. If you don't, you are not a true doer of the word. If you don't properly receive the implanted word, you will not be able to apply its life-saving power. So whenever a Christian ceases to act on his faith, that faith atrophies and becomes little more than a creedal corpse. So we call this a dead orthodoxy. I've heard that before. You have all the correct doctrines down, but you're just kind of bump on a log. So dead orthodoxy is a danger that has always confronted Christians, and we do well to heed this danger. But the antidote is a simple one that we'll look at more next week. Faith remains vital and alive as long as it is being translated into real works of living obedience. So now we can get to our dog pictures, because any important biblical principle can be illustrated with dog pictures. So first one we have, I'll call him Bruticus. And Bruticus is the dead orthodoxy believer that he legitimately believes all the right things, but for one reason or another, he's just become a bump on a log, and he shows up every Sunday. He sits in the pew or the seat or whatever, and he listens, and then he goes home, and he maybe watches a lot of TV, goes to work, comes back next week, just says same thing over, and he doesn't really apply any of it. He's just, that's Bruticus here. And so this guy, you know, he's just sitting here saying, what do you mean you can't see the joy of the Lord on my face? You must be a heathen pagan that's blinded to the things of God. So, you know, we've met that camp, and so this would be very practical information for these guys. But then we got Skippy. Skippy is who we want to be, maybe not so rapid-looking, but something more towards that end. And so he would represent that when we focus our lives on loving God and loving others, a life of service, our faith is energized. It is brought to its proper goal. This is the true hearing that James wants from his readers, the kind of reception that is able to bring life. And so I'd say would find a parallel to another famous passage, Ephesians 2, 8 through 10. We learn in Awana as well. For by grace you've been saved through faith. By grace through faith. And this not of yourselves, it's the gift of God. And it continues on. What does verse 10 say? What was the point of all that? So that you can go and live out all these good works that God has prepared beforehand, that you should walk in them. So it's not the final thing, isn't just believe and then you're done. That's how you are justified and you are on your way to heaven, no ifs and buts. But if you said, what's the proper goal? What are we supposed to be doing with that? That's what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be getting to work. Now, a more general illustration of what this would be teaching when we say works enliven our faith, we see very commonly when we send off teenagers on a mission trip, especially if it's their first one, what's it like when they come back? It's like, for lack of a better phrase, they're basically on a spiritual high because it's like, this is amazing. I did this, and we were to help with these people, and I was able to share this and do this, and we worked on this. And it's incredible to see their excitement, and so you can basically see them glowing with excitement. And that's this principle that when they take what they already believe and they start applying it, it energizes them, and they're excited about it. We can see this in our Bible studies. Those that are out sharing the good news with others, guess what? They have something to share. Come Bible study time, you're like, hey, guess what? I was able to share with my coworker, and we talked about it, making some progress, and so on and so on. What does the person that's just been the bump on the log have to say? Well, we're just like, I watched some more Netflix, I ate some good food, you know. They're not energized or anything about it. So that's the illustration we have here, is that works enliven our faith. And if I had to pick out, just to be mean and pick out some people here to pick on, if you've been around enough to be around any of the Saltzmans, there's not a bad Saltzman here. You will see this principle worked out, that not only do they believe the correct things, but they go out each week and they're applying it, and you can see the excitement in their conversations and what they want to talk about and what really gets them excited. So where does this bring us? Just some summary of some of the misconceptions we've gone over, suggesting that if you boarded the wrong train on these, it's going to give you a lot of difficulty in seeing what's actually there in James 2. Versus what you've been told is there. So first, we looked at the reality of the book of James does have a structure. Second, we looked that James is written to believers. Not a lot of wiggle room there. We reviewed, at least, that save has a wide range of usage, and so you shouldn't just have knee-jerk reactions and say it's always talking about this or that. And we looked at the Greek idiom to save a life, because that's the first instruction he gives after that theme statement, as he's saying, be a true doer of the word, receive this implanted word that's able to save your life. And finally, we looked that the summary of this section we'll be looking at in a few weeks is that works enliven our faith. It brings it to its proper goal. It brings us to where we were supposed to be. And when we do that, we do persevere in trials and we are successful in trials, and our faith is brought to its proper goal. So, and final summary of all this, let's see if I can actually read back there in my turn here. If you are going to apply the implanted word that has the power to save your life, you must be a true hearer or doer of the word. This means that works must be added to your faith to meet the practical needs of others, to demonstrate our faith to others, and to bring our faith to its proper goal. Simply put, works enliven our faith. So obviously there's a lot of components there we haven't looked at yet, but we will in the future, just to give you a little glimpse that this is the bottom line application of what we should be doing with this. So if we said, okay, summarize it even more simply. Bottom line is, if you are a believer, you've trusted in Christ as your only hope of eternal life, and you've been exposed to one extent or another to God's word to know the stuff you should be doing, then there's really just one thing left to say. Just do it. There's not much left. You know, get out there and let your works enliven your faith, because that is the proper goal and the end point that God has in store for us.